Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we conclude our series on the American Civil War with Bruce Chadwick, who talks about how the Civil War has been represented in the movies. And we'll also hear from Alice Randall on what the novel and movie Gone with the Wind aren't about. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On March 28, 1939, one of the most devastating civil wars in modern times came to an end. The Republican defenders of the Spanish city of Madrid raised the white flag of surrender over the city, signaling the end of the Spanish Civil War that endured for nearly 3 years and claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. When the Spanish monarchy was abolished and the Liberal Republic established in 1931, Spain was divided between those in favor of the Republic, the educated middle class, agricultural laborers, and urban workers, and those opposed to radical liberal reforms, namely the Roman Catholic Church, the military, landowners, and businessmen. Both sides resorted to violence and extreme political expression through fascist-oriented parties and left-wing anarchist groups. The elections of February 1936 proved to be the breaking point. A popular front government was set up, which stirred the forces of opposition to mount a military uprising. The warring sides became known to history as the Nationalists and the Republicans. On October 1936, the Nationalists won control, and General Francisco Franco was declared head of state. Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy sent troops and supplies to aid the Nationalists, while the Soviet Union and an international brigade, including American, Mexican, and French volunteers, aided the Republican cause. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a man whose exploits inspired the popular World War II film epic The Great Escape died last month at the age of 86. Desmond Plunkett, a Royal Air Force pilot who was in charge of making maps that the men of Stalag Luft III Nazi prison camp needed to get to safety after escape, was one of 76 men who broke out of the camp on the night of March 23, 1944. Plunkett, who evaded capture for 2 weeks, was one of the last men to be caught. He was returned to a prisoner's camp where he spent the remainder of the war. Washington State Representative Hans Dunshee recently proposed that the highway stretching from the Oregon border to Canada, better known as Highway 99, adopt a new name, one with political connotations very different from those suggested by the road's original given name, the Jefferson Davis Memorial Highway. Offering to rename the highway for William P. Stuart, a black Civil War veteran who fought for the Union, Dunshee drew a hailstorm of opposition from groups like the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the United Daughters of the Confederacy, who described the name change as an affront to the Confederate president. This is Talking History. The Civil War has been the subject of not only a large number of American movies, but also some of its greatest box office hits, like Gone with the Wind. But just how was the war represented in those movies? How realistic or romantic were they? That's the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Fred Nielsen and Bruce Chadwick.
According to Gore Vidal, he who screens the history makes the history. Filmmakers, he insists, are Americans' primary source of historical truth. Movies were in their infancy when a film version of Uncle Tom's Cabin appeared in 1903. When one adjusts for inflation, two of the top five money-making films of all time are Civil War-era movies, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, each with receipts of over $1 billion. The TV movie Roots and the Hollywood film Glory attest to the continuing interest in such productions. If filmmakers have shaped Americans' understanding of the Civil War, what kind of history have they presented? With me today to consider that question is Bruce Chadwick, a lecturer on history and film at Rutgers University, and the author of The Real Civil War, Mythmaking in American Film. Professor Chadwick, welcome.
Fred, how are you?
Just fine. During the era of silent movies, about 500 Civil War films were made. All of them, you say, belong to the Moonlight and Magnolia School. What was that?
It's a nickname that I coined for these type of films. You must remember that movies debuted in 1903. Just about 50 years after the war itself. All the films that Hollywood produced about the Civil War were extensions of this Moonlight and Magnolias myth in literature theater poetry that grew up in the latter half of the 19th century. Transferred onto film, one critic jokingly said that the Moonlight Magnolia School featured modern musketeers. These are the guys. Modern musketeers who duel, hunt, ride, and rescue young ladies. And it was a scenario of southern plantations. These were cavaliers and their belles, partying on wide verandas, gorgeous balls, drinking mint juleps, riding hard through the fields, living a very happy life, productive life, not bothering anybody. And suddenly, the Civil War started. In all these Moonlight Magnolia School of films, slaves are either seen as just backdrop or furniture, very happy in bondage. Their owners respect them, and they respect their owners. And the war suddenly starts. It seems to be nobody's fault. It starts, and all on both sides, North and South, fight gallantly. Throughout the war, Northerners and Southerners have romances with women. There are love triangles where women are in love at the same time or consecutively with soldiers on North and South. No women, however, were ever in love with the abolitionists who were blamed for starting the war. And there's this school of films that comes up again and again through the 500 silents that were all produced around 1910, 1915 to cash in on the 50th anniversary of the war. And they set a tone in the silent era that you see for 80-some years later repeated again and again into the 1970s in sound movies such as So Red the Rose and most poignantly in Gone with the Wind.
Coming exactly 50 years after the end of the war is probably the greatest of the silent films, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. It incorporates some of the elements that you've described already. I wonder if you could describe in more detail, though, what was the story that Birth of a Nation told on screen?
The Birth of a Nation story in the movies came from a record-setting play and a best-selling novel called The Klansman by a fellow named Thomas Dixon, whose uncle, it was discovered later, was in the Ku Klux Klan. It was produced and directed by the best film director of the era, D.W. Griffith, who it turned out 15 years later, he revealed that his father was probably in the Klan. The story was the tale of two brothers from the North who are friendly with two brothers from the South. The Northerner's father is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Their younger daughter, as in all Civil War movies, is beautiful. The beautiful younger daughter falls in love with one of the Southern brothers during the war. That's the first half of the film. Magnolia School. Then things veer into disgrace. The second half of the film, in which all the black soldiers or black slaves or freedmen in the South are seen as rapists, thugs, murderers. The only way to stop them from ruining the entire South is for the Ku Klux Klan to take charge, because the police, the army, and the courts will not. The Klan is founded by Ben, who's in love with the daughter from the North. As a guy, a noble, well-intentioned Southerner, who now, the war over, has to protect hearth and home, and does so by starting up the KKK. They then become the heroes of the movie. And the title ties in with The Birth of a Nation to twist this all around, that somehow in the film, somehow America is in the racism of the Klan, that it wasn't born in the Declaration of Independence, as we had thought previously to that.
Now, by our
ugly movie.
By our standards, it is an ugly movie, as you suggest. What was the public response to it in 1915 when it came out?
It was a huge hit. It was the rival of Harry Potter today. And I'm not disparaging Harry Potter. Different kind of movie. You've got to remember, and what I stress in this book, is that at the time when movies come out, that is what is most important, that the cultural climate of 1915 being such segregationist was that the audiences in America at that time enjoyed the movie because it played into their own view of blacks in America at that time. Also in the movie, what Griffith does throughout the movie and in all the publicity for the movie is to tell American audiences this is a true story. There are cards in silent films between scenes, as all your listeners who have seen them will know from seeing them on TV, where the writing will tell you what's going on in the scene. And these different cards in this movie say, this is historically accurate. This is true. They quote history books. They quoted Woodrow Wilson's history textbook. And all the publicity leads you to believe it's a true story, which it is not. But people believe historical movies are true, and they believe that this story was true. It made in today's money over $1 billion. It played in some movie houses for a year. At the time, movie tickets were a quarter. People then paid $2, compared to about $30 in today's money, to go and see this movie. Critics liked it. Ministers told their flock to go and see it, especially to bring children. Editorialists enjoyed it. The only people who protested it were the NAACP in its infancy, some liberal politicians, and some newspaper editors. But for the most part, it was a huge success. It was the biggest moneymaker of all time until Titanic.
A little bit later, on the eve of World War II, Abraham Lincoln makes an appearance in the movies, and you suggest that two of the most important Lincoln films, Young Mr. Lincoln, appeared in 1939, and Abe Lincoln in Illinois the next year, reflect something of Americans' changing attitudes as World War II approached. What image of Lincoln did these movies present in the late 30s?
The image of Lincoln that they presented, that it's been hard always for Americans to get away from, was the Father Abraham figure, Honest Abe, the rail splitter. Literature and then movies portrayed Abraham Lincoln as a bridge for North and South to reunite after the war. He was seen as a figure who was above politics, almost a religious figure, and being above politics took away all of the political arguments about slavery in the war. So in Young Mr. Lincoln, you see a very noble young lawyer before the Civil War starts. He has no ambition and is above politics, and he defends some brothers involved in a murder trial. Then in Abe Lincoln in Illinois, starring Raymond Massey, you see the older Abe about to become president, leaving Springfield. And in this movie, again, he's portrayed as somebody who has no ambition and is above politics. These movies came out in the late 30s and were very successful critically and commercially, because in the late 30s, America was as apprehensive and nervous about World War II as Americans were about the Civil War on the eve of it 80 years before. So what filmmakers are saying in these movies is that we must rally around Abraham Lincoln now in our troubles against the Nazis, just as Americans did in 1860. And tied into that was the whole concept of FDR serving as the real Abraham Lincoln for Americans. Both movies did very well. And these two movies, too, are on television all the time. Fine films. A view of Lincoln that we see a little bit differently in the 1980s and 90s, but not that much so.
There are certainly some similarities between the two Civil War blockbusters, Birth of a Nation and then later Gone with the Wind. You note that the fingerprints of Birth of a Nation are all over Gone with the Wind. And yet at the same time, you point out that David Selznick, the producer of the latter movie, seems to have learned some lessons from D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, approaching his film in rather different ways. I wonder if you could elaborate on the similarities and differences between those two films.
I think the biggest similarities in the two movies is the concept of the land as something to be held and cherished, and the concept of family. In both Birth of a Nation with the Camerons and Gone with the Wind with the O'Haras and the Wilkeses, early on, in the first 15 minutes of the film, we love the families. They are the heroes. Those who are opposed to the families are the villains, and we don't want anything to happen to these people. Those two are tied together. In both of them, there's the notion that the owners are good to their slaves. Slaves in bondage are happy. That the Southerners in both films are doing no wrong and are suddenly attacked by the Union Army. Now, Selznick, who's Jewish, decides to make this movie, remembering the idolization of the KKK in Birth of a Nation. He doesn't want to do that. In the novel Gone with the Wind, there are numerous references to the Klan, that Rhett Butler and Ashley Wilkes were involved with the Klan. Selznick eliminates the Klan completely in the film. Because at the time, in 1939, the Klan was still very active in America. The Klan kicked in again, the new Klan started, in 1915, after Birth of a Nation came out. By 39, though, in Selznick's view, the new Klan is not just anti-black, but anti-Catholic, and to him, most importantly, anti-Jewish. The Klan is eliminated from the movie entirely. The roles of blacks in the film, while demeaning, are certainly better portrayed, such as Big Sam and Mammy, of course, than blacks in Birth of a Nation. So there are differences, but the idea of land and family is the same for both.
In many of the early films, certainly the portrayal of African Americans is deplorable, as you've suggested. Since the 1970s, that's begun to change with movies like Roots, which appeared on TV and got very high ratings, and then the Hollywood film Glory more recently. How have they changed the Moonlight and Magnolias tradition? And are they more accurate in their portrayal of history?
Well, I'll tell you, I remember Roots vividly because I think they almost took Monday Night Football off the air because the ratings plunged because the whole country watched Roots that night. It was a television phenomenon. And what I try to argue in the book is that the deplorable roles of African Americans, not just in Civil War films, but in films and TV until the 1960s, are tied into the way that blacks are perceived in America per se, that there was a lot of segregation in the country at that time. After the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s and 70s, that changes a lot. The films, general interest films about African Americans, portray them in a better light. Television series, particularly in the late 60s and 70s. So this opens the door for a television miniseries like Roots to give a much more authentic portrayal of slavery. And then 10 or 15 years later for Glory, which of course is the story of black Civil War and their bravery in the war. So it gives you a much more realistic view of black life in slavery and in the Civil War that couldn't have been there before.
Walt Whitman remarked that the real Civil War would never get into the books. I wonder, has the real Civil War gotten into the movies?
Well, also there's another critic, a fellow named Russell Merritt, who does a lot of writing for film magazines. And you mentioned Walt Whitman. He has this Merritt has this great line about The Birth of a Nation, where he says, "The Birth of a Nation is not a historical document any more than are Walt Whitman's poems about the Civil War." So there's an old saying that history is written by the winners. And that is the truth about the Civil War. It was sanitized and rewritten considerably in the late 19th century and since then. I think that today, much more authentic history about the war, the reasons for the war and slavery, are in books today because there's a new generation of historians that are taking a new look at it. I think that's true in movies, too, that you see more honest portrayals of the Civil War in films and TV series, films such as Roots, the TV series Gettysburg, which is one of my favorites. And I think that over the last few years you've seen more of that, and you will see more of that, as there's more of an authentic look and more historians are used as consultants and as audiences have a more open mind about what the possibilities were for history.
Well, Professor Chadwick, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
I've been visiting with Bruce Chadwick, the author of The Real Civil War, Mythmaking in American Film.
Alice Randall has written one of the most controversial novels of recent years, The Wind Ungone. In that book, and in this week's commentary, she explodes the world created by Margaret Mitchell in her famous 1936 novel, the work that more than any other has defined our image of the antebellum South, Gone with the Wind.
I'm often asked why I wrote The Wind Ungone. When I was a little girl in Detroit, my father, who claimed never to have worn a pair of shoes until he was 13 years old, would get soaked in Cutty Sark, a kind of Scotch whiskey, and pronounce his desire for me. He would say, "I want you to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves." And he would elaborate, "When some nigger down in the corner is in trouble for something he ain't done, and the only thing between him and the electric chair is a phone booth and Don, I want him to call you. And I want you to listen to his words. Then I want you to use your words and make them know his truth." I wrote this book so people would know Cinnamon's truth. Know the truth of a character who might have written her words down but got them lost because she lived surrounded by those who could not afford to value words on paper. Cinnamon is a fictional creation, but she's based on real women. I've been told about it in my own family history, in my family, husband's family, and in my ex-husband's family. She is also very specifically a parody and critique of another novel, the novel Gone with the Wind. I decided that Gone with the Wind needed to be parodied and critiqued for three very specific reasons. One, it presents black women as being unintelligent. Two, it presents black politicians as being ineffectual. And three, it presents the proper role of the black mother as to raise no child of her own, but to care and tend a white child as her job. My father used to also say, "Speak up, son, you're not down south." And I keep thinking of those immortal words of George Clinton. Why must I be like that? Why must I chase the cat? Nothing but the dog and me. Well, I'm a daughter and I'm living in the South, and I've got to tell it that truth, even if it ain't nothing but the dog and me. This book is about speaking up for those who cannot speak for themselves, because the illiterate dead are too often silent. My book is a rebuke and scorn of Gone with the Wind, a text that has misrepresented the African-American experience of being enslaved, the Southern experience of owning slaves, and a book that has specifically injured generations of African-American women. It has attempted to heal some of those wounds. It is attempting to provide a kind of transformative laughter while we rebuke and scorn these old notions, including notions in Gone with the Wind, of the Civil War and the reasons that was fought, but mainly the people who were fighting it. Gone with the Wind presents the slaves as being incompetent and unintelligent. In my book, I have a black congressman who knows about slaves who fought in the Civil War with bravery and courage. My congressman, my character, my black congressman, fought in the Civil War with courage. It takes note of something that is noted nowhere in all the pages of Gone with the Wind about, this is one example of an aspect of history that I am adding to. However, my subject is not the Civil War. My subject is not American racism. My subject is the book, Gone with the Wind, and the injury it has inflicted on generations of Americans. And that's why I wrote The Wind Ungone.
You've been listening to Alice Randall, author of The Wind Ungone, and this is Talking History. We thought it appropriate for the final site of the week in our series on the American Civil War to tell you about the ultimate Civil War source, online at least. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In what can only be described as amazing, Richard Dobbins, a former mutual fund manager and founder of several financial databases, has taken it upon himself to create the Civil War Research Database, What once could take days or months to find is now available on your desktop. For $25 a year, you can log on to CivilWarData.com and find out just about anything about a soldier who fought in the Civil War. Looking for records of a relative and where and when he was killed? You will probably be able to find out by searching the database. Dobbins has entered by hand into a sophisticated computer database millions of personnel records from some 170 sources. They detail induction dates, promotions, combat service, causes and locations of death, and more. For the past 135 years, this information has been scattered. Instead of combing through reels and reels of microfiche, the information is available at your fingertips on CivilWarData.com. As Dobbins himself says, from the richness of the data, you can learn what really happened to these people.
And finally, looking ahead to upcoming events of historical interest, March 30th might be called the Peter, Paul, and Mary Night, but you won't be hearing any folk singers. Instead, it is the evening, on the eve of Easter, mind you, when the History Channel will tell the stories of the three pillars of Christianity. In St. Peter, the Rock, the History Channel explores the life of the man who went from fisherman to fisher of men, who became the leader of the apostles and the rock upon which the foundation of the church was built. The Apostle Paul tells the story of another ordinary man who became a legend, transforming the world in the process. Paul's conversion secured the legacy of Jesus and Christianity. And finally, in Mary of Nazareth, we learn of the woman who gave birth to the Savior of her people. Little is written in the Gospels about the most revered woman in history, so the documentary goes beyond the scriptures to piece together the life of Mary, her relationship with her son, and her in Christianity. Be sure to check your local listings for the show times of Peter, Paul, and Mary on the History Channel on March 30th. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and our series on the American Civil War. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.